You can tell them in the country, tell them in the town. The miners down in Mingo laid their shovels down. We won't pull another pillow, another ton, or lift another finger till the union we have won. Stand up, boys, let the bosses know. Turn your buckets over, turn your lanterns low. There's fire in our hearts and fire in our soul, but there ain't gonna be no fire in the hole.
This is the Labor Exchange on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. I'm your host, Robert Lindgren, with the Colorado AFL-CIO and Denver Newspaper Guild. Our guest today is Alejo Gonzalez, an organizer for the Service Employees International Union, Local 105, and also a member of the Denver Newspaper Guild. Welcome to the Labor Exchange, Alejo.
Glad to be here.
Awesome. We like to start off our shows by getting to know our guests a little bit more. So let's start with having you tell me a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So my name is Alejo. I've been organizing electoral, community, labor, coming up on about 10 years now. I first started my journey as a care worker. I was working in an after-school program with developmentally disabled and at-risk youth, and organized there with the community to focus on making things better for the kids. I think seeing how like the flawed system we have was affecting kids, like, really lit a fire in me. Cause these kids don't have any skin in the game as far as, they're just born to their situation. And seeing how like poverty and how, low paying jobs were affecting how much time they get to spend with their loved ones, with their parents. It really just put me in a place where I wanted to make change.
Yeah, that's great. And, I really appreciate that spark that got you into the work. I just want to pull out a little bit more though about you as a person. Where'd you grow up? What's your family like? What's some passions? Not going to make you talk about boxing, but I know that's a part of your life. So, I just wanted to get a feel for stuff for our listeners.
Man, I wish boxing could be more a part of my life, but with an organizer schedule, and get over to the boxing gym over here on Alameda, Phil Beta Boxing. Great gym. I actually grew up in a town called Normal, Illinois. Good old Midwestern city. Both my parents immigrated here. Dad's from Chile, mom's from Spain. Very close with my godmother also, who is Cuban. So those are some of my influences growing up. And my little sister Emma, who's always been an actress and a theatrical person. So that's kind of my core right there, man. And my mom grew up north of Portugal, working class. Dad was a grandpa, was a butcher. And then my father grew up in Chile, pretty poor as far as finances go, in a big family, and was a union organizer himself down in Chile during, Allende's time, and he was organizing farmers. And then obviously, when the coup happened, my father was imprisoned and for 3 years. For folks who don't know the history of Chile, those prisons weren't great. So, my father sacrificed a lot of his livelihood for the cause. And, it's funny because growing up, I didn't know he was a labor organizer. It wasn't until I moved to Denver and told him I was one, he was like, oh, yeah, I did that too. I was like, well, that would have been good to know. But I always heard the stories about the political struggle down there and stuff. And they always tried to let me sort of develop my own ideology throughout my experiences. It's funny that I ended up in the same place, doing the same work my dad did, down in Chile, because, I guess it's a generational thing.
Yeah, well, and it really, it does highlight, you know, some of the dangers of union organizing. I think that's not, you know, we don't always feel right now, although it is present in America, but if you're in the global South organizing unions, it's, you know, incredibly dangerous. So it's kind of like you have that history in your family, but like in a visceral way where, you know, sort of the stakes, I guess, is what I'm hearing a little bit.
Oh, 100%, man. Like, you know, any rise in fascism is always tied with a stripping of labor rights, you know? And so, I mean, my first year organizing with SEIU, I just graduated college, was 16. So I'm in North Carolina, right? Like, I just got sent over to help with this campaign over there with SEIU. And, you know, I'm falling asleep to the news and I wake up, Trump won. Right. I was just like, holy shit. Sorry.
You got bleeps. I figured it out.
But, you know, I remember driving down the highway to get to this little strip mall office that we were in. And as I'm driving, I look up in one of the overpasses and there's this fully dressed KKK member holding up a Hail Trump sign.
Wow.
And so I'm just like, man, this is what I'm getting into, right? Like, this is right when I get into labor, this is what we're up against, you know? So it was backs to the wall for a while, man, you know, and definitely thought a lot about my dad and what he went through, and knowing that labor was a target for Trump and for fascists around the world, gotta be careful.
Yeah, and you know, just as a human, or even as the children of immigrants, how did that feel to see something that sort of striking right then?
You know, it was kind of like a wake-up call, right? Like, I was in college, sort of like insulated from some politics, you know, in the general level. I interned at the Capitol in Missouri, and I mean, you know anything about the Missouri legislature, it's ruby red, right? And so there was a lot of rhetoric there with a lot of awesome labor champions in Missouri trying to advocate for working people. And even some Republicans were pro-labor in Missouri. But I think, like, leaving the university context, right, and then, like, just getting hit across the face with it, it was almost like there's work to be done, you know, like it's time to buck up, you know? So I think really what I felt was I was scared and I was nervous because I was also in North Carolina and I didn't really know the area.
I wanted to talk about SEIU 105, so Service Employees International Union. Like, so amongst the labor movement, this is a, you know, I will say a legendary local, you know, the Justice for Janitors movement. Are you able to share any of the history of your union?
Yeah, man. Local 105 is a historic, labor hub, going back to Corky Gonzalez and the Chicano movement, right? And, you know, there was a lot of, Chicano folks organizing with the Crusade for Justice and talking about, how they're being treated in society, right? And how there's massive inequality, right? In so many different levels. And so I believe that a lot of that trickled into the workforce eventually, right? People were talking about these things and how they needed to change at a society level, community level, political level. Obviously, it's going to translate to labor. And so, what came out of it was the master contract for the janitors, which is this amazing historical contract that basically allows folks who are working in commercial buildings as janitors to be able to be a part of a union. And it encompasses so many people. I think it's like over 2,000 janitors across the state in this contract. And it's just such a powerful thing that, you know, is housed here in 105 with such a rich history, that it's not just like one building bargaining for their rights, right? With the master contract, you've got janitors from all different buildings, all different companies who are able to sit together and bargain together. And that's a lot of power, right? And so it's just awesome to be in here in that history. That was the team I worked on when I first joined the local back in 19. And oh my gosh, man, I wish we could get some janders in here to talk to you too, because the stories they have of the struggle throughout the years, it's truly remarkable. Healthcare workers here with Kaiser Permanente and beyond, with WellPower, with winning Planned Parenthood, and representing them, even now, with the way that our politics are going, having some representation there to make sure that those workers are supported and providing good services for the clients that they want to serve. 105 really is just a staple in my mind, in Colorado, for what labor should be doing, fighting at a political front, fighting on the ground with the workers, and really advocating, across industries for better working conditions and just respect, man. Just respect, like, just comes down to that, it's just respect. And we have an unofficial saying, it's gonna get beat, but it's, you don't with 105.
Yeah, we have to beep that one, but absolutely. I mean, that's part of the swagger, I would say. If folks are on Twitter, Union Drip has been trending. Like, it feels like you guys were Union Dripping 10 years ago when I first was introduced to the group. Like, it's just like there is that bit of swagger. I was gonna say too, that master contract. So it's a way to gain power when you have contractors that potentially would play off each other. And part of the conversation I know we want to get to is talking about sectoral bargaining, which I feel is a very similar, at least, idea of, avoid the individual company, which ends up making it so that you're bargaining over, they can always go to a different contractor that does less. And so instead, you try to get a master agreement that if you're in these big buildings downtown, you're going to have a, this set of agreements, whatever contractors employing the people there, those people will have that contract. And I don't know if I described that great, but I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about sectoral bargaining, your understanding of it, or just describe and define it for our listeners.
Yeah. My job now is external healthcare. So I focus on organizing new unions, right? And I'm focused on organizing with the home care workers as well, who it's a big fight for home care workers. But I mean, part of having a union and winning it is also like identifying how much bargaining power do you have, right? So, let's say you've got this chain of hospitals, right, that you're organizing, and you organize one out of the, 10 chains, right? At that point, when you're bargaining with that one hospital compared to all 10 of them, like, the boss really has a leg up. They've got nine other places that they're not worried about, right? You got 10% of their market. That's not a lot, right? It's something, and those workers deserve it. But when it comes to actually being able to hold, decision makers accountable, by, doing actions and getting a lot of the workers on board, getting a lot of the clients and patients on board with the fact that like services need to improve through a union, bargaining power really is the key, right? And so when we talk about sectoral bargaining, we talk about things, like in California right now, they're really trying to get like fast food workers to be able to get to the table, right? But what's the problem? You got one shop that just gets shut down if they try and organize. Then they say, oh, well, you got to organize the whole franchise before you can have a union. Or, oh, you got to organize, you see it with Starbucks too, right? Where they've got, over 200 shops organized, shops, Starbucks Workers United. And, several of them here in Colorado that are still facing retaliation, and, need the backing of the community. And the thing is, right, if Starbucks could just bargain as Starbucks, as all the workers, that is so much more bargaining power that you have at the table to demand better working conditions from your boss. Because we see what they're doing with Starbucks. They're shutting down stores, they're changing people's schedules so they quit. They're retaliating against people for showing up a minute or two late, right? And it's because it's store by store, and it makes it so much harder to be able to get to the vision that the workers want, which is a place where they can go to work, make a living, where they can live in the city that they're working in, right? And be able to live a life of respect. So sectoral bargaining really is about leveling the playing field with bargaining power to where an industry, right, or a franchise can bargain at a bigger level and have more bargaining power to be able to win the things that are needed.
Yeah. And I think in the United States, there's not good analogs for that, because there was some early legislation that allowed sectoral bargaining or national bargaining, let's say bargaining by sector, by section of the economy. Retail, I think, could be one. Fast food, again, is another one. Home health care, I think, is interesting to me, because let's maybe take a step back. And you want to just describe home health care workers. What do they do? Who are we talking about when we say home health care?
Yeah. So, home health. So I was a care worker, but I worked in a different setting, right? But home health is just like this industry that is like basic infrastructure for people. Like just how you need to drive, use the highway to get to work and back, and pick up your groceries and back, right? Just to live a regular life. People depend on a home care worker for the same thing, right? So this industry, as I've been talking with home care workers and understanding it better, like it's coming from a historically underpaid and just not paid labor force, right? I mean, first we go in all the way back to slavery, right? Where you had women in the house taking care of the family, taking care of the sick ones for nothing, right? They were property. Then you move into, you know, more like domestic labor, right? That a woman was expected to stay at home, take care of the kids, take care of the house, can't get a credit card, right? Can't even own credit. And all that labor going to nothing, $0 in their pocket, right? They're not building any wealth. And so now you've got home care, right? Which is this industry, which is folks who go and help people at their house, who sometimes, you know, they just may have a, you know, physical disability, intellectual, whatever it might be. And they go and do things from, you know, cooking and cleaning and doing grocery shopping to, you know, medical care, CNA work, to even hospice, right? To where like where, you know, they're joining somebody and they're transitioning into the next life. And this industry is still massively disrespected. I mean, you know, home care workers have been fighting for a long time with Colorado Care Workers Unite. And just won a $15 minimum wage across the state.
Yeah, congratulations on that.
Thanks. You know, the workers worked hard for that. You know, they talked with politicians, they engaged them, they talked to one another, they built, you know, support. But we know here in Colorado that 15 still is just scraping, you know, by barely. And you're talking about a workforce that drives a lot, right? And most of the time isn't getting any money for travel and back. We're talking about a workforce that if a client passes away, now they've lost half their income and they can't pay their bills. We're talking about an industry that just went through COVID and has to make the decision of no sick time. So going to work sick, take care of their loved one who, or, you know, the person they have such a close relationship with COVID, or pay their bills, just be able to pay their rent. Right. And that's the decisions that these home care workers have had to make. I think the thing to really focus on here is just like how isolated they are. Like they don't talk to any coworkers. They don't get a chance to do that. And when we talk about like organizing, right, and building unions, the traditional ways, you go in with cards, you get to a majority and then you turn them in. But how the heck are you supposed to do that if they never see each other?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's a tough industry, and it's almost this like cathartic thing when they all come together with CC Wu, right? And they're able to see people doing the work they're doing, right? And they're like talking about it, complaining about it, you know, just like everybody does. We all complain about our jobs. And it's really cool to just see them almost like jump at the excitement of like seeing other people doing their work. And just be able to vent, be able to talk about the changes that need to happen, be able to talk about the struggle. I mean, we have a board with CC Wu, and at one point, I believe half our board members were homeless.
Yeah, and that's, you know, the truth of that workforce. That's and these are so essential to people being able to age in place. Like, yeah. if that's a value we hold, these are the people who are going to make it happen, right?
Absolutely. And we're talking about an industry with like an over 60% turnover rate every year, you know? And if we want to keep up with the aging population, you know, there's a lot of, I think there's, by policymakers, there's a lot of solutions thrown out there that are not getting to the root of it, which is the fact that they need good paying jobs with benefits, right? Like, that's the root. And why people aren't staying is because they can't survive. They are homeless. They're, you know, whatever it might be.
All right, listeners, you're listening to The Labor Exchange on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. Our guest today is Alejo Gonzalez, an organizer with the Service Employees International Union, Local 105. We've been talking about home health care, sectoral bargaining, and just the state of working people in Colorado. What I wanted to pull out a little bit more, Alejo, is, to me, the home healthcare workforce is something that I think makes sense to be bargained sectorally. We have, so it's this idea that we all know that we want our loved ones to be able to age in place. And then I guess I would go more into the idea of it as infrastructure. How would we pay for it and make sure that we have good people that can come to homes and help folks while they themselves are also, you know, paid a living wage that they can sustain and can, you know, provide upkeep on their cars that are so important to this?
That's a lot of questions there.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, you see some examples of like Nevada and Minnesota and Washington where they develop like standards boards, right? Where they're able to talk directly, because a lot of these services receive public funding, right? Medicare, Medicaid dollars. And you see a lot of these examples in these different states where they're able to talk directly with decision makers and even people receiving the services being involved in that discussion, right? Directly with these decision makers at the state level and advocating for funding, advocating for things like that. I think one thing to be super clear about though, right? Is there was a lot of money that went into home care, right? During, you know, the ARPA bucks and all of that, right? And it's the same thing that's happened across not just home care, right? It's not just a home care specific issue, but several different industries of where'd all that money go, right?
Yeah.
It didn't go to the workers' pockets as much as it went to some folks up top, right? And so I think part of like, really like being accountable to, you know, like home care, like to just like the workers themselves is really focused on like how, where are these bucks going? Right. Like, how are we being accountable to this money coming into these agencies to, make sure it gets to the frontline worker? Because here's the important thing to understand about labor. Without a worker, these CEOs aren't getting a buck. The labor is what produces all the wealth, right? And so you've got all these home care workers who are getting just, you know, exploited a lot of times by these agencies and aren't seeing where that money's going. And I understand, you know, that there's some home care agencies that are smaller and who are trying to pay well, good wages and stuff like that. And that's where it needs to go back to decision makers to make the priority straight. We need these standards for this industry and we need the funding behind it to make it happen so that these people can have the client services they need.
Well, that brings back to that master contract that SEIU members have with the large buildings downtown, and that's the good actors, the people who are trying to pay well, have people retained, keep a workforce that's sustained and can continues to be there, they get undercut by bad actors. So I wanted to ask for our listeners, either folks that are home healthcare workers themselves or folks that just want to do something in support of this workforce, you know, what could they be doing?
Robert, you know, as a good organizer, we always got asks, right? Right now, what home care workers are fighting for across the state of Colorado is called the Home Care Worker Bill of Rights. So you can find that at bit.ly/support-co-care. And really what that is it's laying out just having some standards in the industry, right? So like, number one, like protections from bad bosses, right? Being able to like really have, since they're so isolated, like I was saying earlier, right? Like having some avenue to where they can, have some sort of protection from, wage theft and from other violations, right? The big one, a guaranteed livable wage. If I had a loved one who needed care, I would not want somebody coming in who's homeless and struggling themselves to take care of them, right? That care worker deserves the love and respect they're giving my love, right? I think another issue that happens, highlighted in the Home Care Bill of Rights, is a workplace free from harm. Unfortunately, there's a lot of times where there's sexual harassment, assault, discrimination on the job, and there's really no way to report it. Again, they never see each other, right? They just get a call from the agency saying, go here, go there, and then something happens, and they're like, oh, sorry to hear that. We still need those Medicare bucks coming in, right? Go back, right? And so like having a way where they can protect themselves from that and having a good reporting system. The guaranteed minimum benefits, that's definitely a staple. Having paid holidays off, having health insurance, sick time for a healthcare worker, you think that would be a no-brainer. But if anyone listening here thinks every healthcare worker has sick days off and like affordable health insurance, newsflash, not everybody does. And then finally getting to like the point of it, right? Like decision-making power. These work thing all of the wealth for these agencies. And some of them are extremely uber wealthy, right? And to be able to be the workers as a group and say, you know what, we deserve this, we deserve that, right? That's decision-making power, where they can actually go straight to the decision maker at an equal playing field, right? And say, we deserve this, we're demanding this, right? And be able to fight for those things and get it, and then have it guaranteed. No promises, but guarantees, And you'll hear from anti-union campaigns like, oh, like this union, they're getting in between our great relationship. They're just gonna take all your money. My door's open. Come talk to me whenever you want. But like, if that was the case, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be here asking for space to talk to you. Your door has not been open. And on top of that, since when have you been worried about the money I'm making? Now that the dues conversation's coming up, right? Now you want to talk about my money? I've been talking about my money for a minute, right? And now you're going to come up to me and say, oh, worry about your money? You worry about my money. I need a raise, right? So that's the Home Care Bill of Rights, is those five planks. bit.ly/supportcareco. If you are a decision maker, you're a legislator, if you are a community member who has a family member receiving services, or even not, just something you used to do and you're retired, please sign that Bill of Rights.
I certainly want to dig in a little bit more with you on it, but I feel like this has been a great introduction. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, man, thanks for having me. I look forward to future conversations about all those things and, see if we can get that good word out there.
Great. This has been the Labor Exchange on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. I'm your host, Robert Lindgren, with the Colorado AFL-CIO and Denver Newspaper Guild. Our guest today has been Alejo Gonzalez, an organizer for the Service Employees International Union, Local 105. Thanks again for being on the show.
And also a member of the DNG.
Oh, yeah, I'm not going to forget that one. 37074.
That's right.